that we've been talking about Sunday and how it came to be the established day of worship in the church. It took a long time for it to develop and evolve. And side by side with the Sabbath day, the church, even the Catholic Church, acknowledged the biblical basis of worship on the Sabbath. But because of largely their Jewish, anti-Jewish feelings, the Sabbath came to be a day that you acknowledged as a day of studying the Scriptures, of religious services of various kinds, but a day on which work was required so that you would not be associated with Jews and or Judaizers who were Christians. Sunday, of course, had become the day of the Lord, and it's now commonly called by the 3rd, 4th, and into the 5th centuries, commonly called the Lord's Day, which it's called to this day. The common Christian name for Sunday is the Lord's Day. It isn't the Lord's Day at all, but that's what they call it. Now, these things became solidified in the course of time, and the church had to take official stands and official positions. There is, in one sense of the word, a biblical basis for doing that. As we note in Acts chapter 15, there is the council that was called, if we want to use the Catholic term. The ministers assemble together to decide issues that have become difficult. In the case of the Bible example, there was the question of circumcision, more involving Gentiles being converted to the faith, and what do they have to do? There followed over the years other ecumenical councils, and when we come into the 400s, there is an important ecumenical council that summarizes what had gone on for the first 400 years in the church. This is the Council of Laodicea. Laodicea, that is the city of Laodicea in Asia Minor, where the council was convened. Let me rephrase that. It is the Synod of Laodicea that was convened. Late in the 300s, I got ahead of myself by a paragraph. Late in the 300s, the Synod of Laodicea was called. And in that synod, they discussed these issues. Now, a synod differs from a council, an ecumenical council, in that a synod is made up of lesser officials or smaller numbers and does not have the weight of an ecumenical council. An ecumenical council is that which is assembled for the purpose of determining doctrine in the church. A synod may discuss things that later would be discussed in an ecumenical council. And I mentioned that because, and I want you to correct your notes, be sure you get Synod of Laodicea down. I say that because sometimes we have passed quickly over, just as I did, my eyes skipped down to my next paragraph, and even confuse the terms. So I've heard a number of our ministers do that in the past. I'd like to get that clarified as much as we can. The Synod of Laodicea was convened in the late 300s. It's difficult to put a date on it. Different works put different dates on it, but they late in the 300s. And discussed a number of important matters that in 451... were officially adopted by the ecumenical council that was convened in that year. So the year of the ecumenical council is 451, and it's called the Council of Chalcedon. C-H-A-L-C-E-D-O-N. C-H-A-L-C-E-D-O-N. Chalcedon, which is also the name of a city in Asia Minor, I presume, although I have never bothered to look up much of the geography of some of these places. Now, you can think of the Council of Chalcedon and the Synod of Laodicea somewhat simultaneously, because the council that was convened in 451 approved officially the resolutions of the Synod of Laodicea. And so if you're talking to somebody who's not too concerned about it, it's not of major importance, because you would discuss what happened in the church at this time, and I'm going to read you some of the results of that in a moment. And they are very significant, of course, to God's church. What was happening in this period of time, late in the 300s and into the middle of the 400s. As we're seeing more and more and more the power of the church at Rome the bishop at Rome, who has not yet become the pope, by the way. We still haven't got him the pope yet. We still haven't got him in charge of everything, and we're coming, you know, 400 years past the time of Christ. But it's growing. That power is growing. Very much so. So you should think in terms of what happened in Laodicea in the late 300s as being adopted officially by the church at the Council of Chalcedon. And yet, many of our ministers may talk more about what happened at Laodicea and even say, incorrectly, the Council of Laodicea. So we should keep that as straight as we can. So you understand the difference between councils and synods, then. There have been, in the course of the last 2,000 years, just over 20 ecumenical councils. So they don't get called very often. Just over 20 of them. The last one was convened in the 1960s. I've mentioned this already. But it didn't have any major pronouncements to make. It was just a general thing, and they got together, and the basic thrust of that was, let's try to expand our horizons and reestablish relationships with the Eastern Orthodox churches and the Protestant churches of the world and bring Christianity back into the one true fold of the church. That was the basic thrust of what happened in the 60s. There were other things that were done, but nothing major. Okay, relevant to what was happening then in the council or synod that was held in Laodicea, the Encyclopedia Britannica tells us this about it. Held at Laodicea and Lycum in Phrygia sometime between the 340s and the 380s. So you see, even the Encyclopedia Britannica says we just don't know when it was held. There's no official date, but the late 300s is okay. It adapted 60 canons of the church. Now, a canon is a synonym for a law, the way you should think of it. A canon, C-A-N-O-N, is a law that is adopted, or a resolution, a practice that will now be firmly established, officially adopted by the church, and it must be adhered to be in the church. And there were 60 of these signed into law, and then by the Council of Chalcedon in 451 were officially accepted. They were chiefly disciplinary matters of the priesthood. That's what most of the canons had to do with, which were declared ecumenical, that is, religiously the law of the church, by the Council of Chalcedon in 451. The most significant canons are those directly affecting the clergy, wherein the clergy appear as a privileged class, far above the laity, but with sharply differentiated and carefully graded orders within itself. Now here is where what has been evolving for 400 years finally is established, the order of the hierarchy of the church. Now, there's nothing specifically wrong with the hierarchy of the church. I mean, after all, that comes from the Bible. You see deacons and deaconesses, you see elders, you see teachers, pastors, evangelists, prophets, apostles in the church. So that's a biblically based organizational structure, except it didn't take on, and the Bible doesn't give it in the mold of the Roman Empire. The Catholic Church had established its hierarchy based on the Roman emperors, from the emperor, who was Pontifex Maximus, down through the senators and proconsuls and governors and kings and governors and so on down the line. The Church had established them on that same grade. So we now see sharply differentiated and carefully graded orders for the clergy. For example, the priests are not to be chosen by the people. Well, we'd probably go along with that, too. Penitents are not to be present at the ordination, that is, new people who are just coming into the church, lest they should hear the failings of the candidates discussed. Other canons treat intercourse with heretics, where God's people are going to come into play. Admission of penitent heretics, that is, someone who has gone astray into heresy but now wants to come back into the one true church, the Roman Catholic Church, the way they view it. Fasting, baptism, Lent, now is discussed and decided at this time, which I mentioned because we're in that season right now. Angel worship, which is forbidden by the Catholic Church. And what books of the Bible are in the sacred canon, that is, inspired books of the Bible. Interestingly enough, this is 451. The Apocrypha is not accepted at this council as sacred scripture. the Apocrypha, you know, are the added books which we do not acknowledge as being Scripture, but the Roman Catholic Church does. There are a number of them at the end of the Old Testament. Usually in the Catholic version of the Bible, they're placed between the two Testaments. The Book of Maccabees, telling the story of what happened in the couple of centuries before Jesus, and the various other books, too. The Apocrypha is not accepted as canon at this time. Interestingly, neither is the Book of Revelation, accepted by the Catholic Church as canon at this time. Now, continuing at what was adopted either in Laodicea or Chalcedon, the Encyclopedia Britannica continues further. The Council of Chalcedon, which was the fourth ecumenical council of the Church, the Catholic Church, was held in 451, its occasion being the Eutychian heresy, which also had to do, and they still were having problems with, the nature of Christ and who he was, what he was. In response to the imperial summons, 500 to 600 bishops, all Eastern except the Roman legates and two Africans, assembled in Chalcedon on the 8th of October in 451. The Bishop of Rome claimed for his legates the right to preside and insisted that any act that failed to receive their approval would be invalid. But that was a controversy. The first session was tumultuous. Party feeling ran high, and scurrilous and vulgar epithets were bandied to and fro. Imagine a group of priests cursing one another and kicking one another out of the church and doing all, you know, they had to grow. The part of the church was still having its difficulties. The emperor requested a declaration of the true faith, but the sentiment of the council was to oppose to the new symbol. It contented itself with reaffirming the Nicene and Constantinopolitan creed and the Ephesine formula of 431, which I won't go into. The council rejected both Nestorianism and Eutychianism and stood upon the doctrine that Christ had two natures, each perfect in itself and each distinct from the other, yet perfectly united in one person. He was at once both God and man. And of course, this has been an eternal controversy of who or what was Jesus. And even in the Christian world and the doctrines of the churches, there are some variations. Say, if you read the Mormon interpretation versus the Jehovah's Witness interpretation versus the traditional Catholic or mainline Protestant interpretation of who or what was Jesus, you see some of these early theologies still are at play. For example, isn't it the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Jesus was a created being? I think that is the official position of that body. I'm not positive of that. Rather than an eternal being. The Catholics have come pretty close in that regard, I believe. The most important enactments of the Council of Chalcedon, however, were the following. One, the approval of the canons of the first three ecumenical councils. So now we really, in 451, established that what has happened up to this time is officially declared law. But it took 450 years for this to occur. And the synods, that is the first three councils, and now the synods that have been more recently convened at a variety of cities, including the one at Laodicea. So in 451, it sort of wrapped everything up and say, okay, we decree that what has transpired in these synods and these councils is official canon of the church. Everyone has got to believe it. It, secondly, forbade trade and secular pursuits and war to the clergy. So they couldn't serve in the military, and they could not involve themselves in secular pursuits. Interestingly enough, this was to be a major problem in the Catholic Church for hundreds of years in the future, that the Catholic Church did involve itself in secular pursuits, became landowners and very wealthy, and this led, of course, ultimately to the Protestant Reformation and to Martin Luther, in part. There were other factors, too. So even their priests didn't really abide by this. Bishops not even being allowed to administer the property of their diocese. Now, that's official law of the Church, 451. And yet it is a major problem in the 10, 11, 12, and 13, and 1400s, leading to Martin Luther's ultimate revolt over what Catholic priests were doing in their diocese and their control of land and wealth and business, commerce. Three, it forbade monks and nuns to marry, although that had been evolving right along. The doctrine of celibacy had come into the church from the influence of those early Stoic philosophers that were converted to Christianity we talked about earlier. Some of the early influence of the church fathers, Tertullian, Origen, and those men who introduced the concept of priestly celibacy. Now it's official. Monks and nuns are forbidden to marry or to return to the world. Once in a while, you read about a priest or a nun who leaves the sacred order and becomes a normal citizen. But it is rare that such a thing does occur. They are forbidden once they accept the vows. And of course, before you take the vows, you've got to go through quite a period of training to become a monk or a nun. And you don't accept those vows until you allegedly know what you're doing and know you can never return to the world to do it. But, you know, you've got sort of the Sound of Music story, which most of you have probably seen, of the young girl who, Maria, who almost, well, did she ever take the vows? I can't remember if she did or not. I guess she didn't, did she? And that was based basically on a true story. But you get a feel of what the difficulties are in some of those things. Likewise, forbidding the establishment of a monastery in a diocese without the consent of the bishop, and the disestablishment of a monastery once it's consecrated. So monasteries, secluded places for the monks and the nuns to go to, sometimes conveniently located fairly close to each other. Subterranean passages between them, that's getting a little bawdy. Maybe I better not. History backs it up, though. And fourth, punishing with the deposition and ordination or clerical appointment made for money. That's called simony in the religious terminology, from Simon the Magician, back in the book of Acts, who bought or tried to buy, didn't succeed, but offered to buy a clerical office, using that term, with money. And forevermore his name has been placed upon the practice of doing that, of offering money for the ministry or to serve in the priesthood or the ministry. Interestingly enough, this too was a major difficulty. I'll read you a little later, a few weeks from now, before we conclude the year. I'll read you a number of stories about what happened in the Catholic Church over a period of hundreds of years when, in practicality, almost all the priests bought their office with money, paid for it. Some of them as young as 6, 8, and 10 years of age. Their fathers purchased the clerical office. The reason was, when you were a priest, you had land. And when you had land, you had power and money. And you had these huge estates that now are the wine-growing areas of France and Italy that were once controlled by the priests of the church in the 11, 12, 13, 1400s. This forbade and punished people who did that. Didn't do any good later. The Roman Emperor Marcion approved the doctrinal decrees of the council and enjoined silence in regard to their theological questions. Eutychus and Dioscorus and their followers were deposed and banished. But harmony was not thus to be restored. Hardly had the council dissolved when the church was plunged into a monophysite controversy, and I won't go into that one either because there's so many things that go on. So you can see what happened in 451, and yet it really didn't change some things. Some interesting canons of the church, I'll just read them to you for the almost, let's say, the fun of it type of a thing. You see what was taking place, and you can see what was happening, and you can read between the lines where God's people must have been and how it must have been for them. Now we can presume, as a result of the council in Laodicea in 325, that true believers, people who kept the Passover and the holy days, people who were continuing to faithfully observe the Sabbath, were now made very difficult to openly practice. It was decreed heresy. Their property could be confiscated by the church. And later, after the Council of Nicaea in 325, we've got more than 100 years has gone by now. The church is in an extremely powerful position, having officially been accepted as the emperor's church. And the emperors were generally regarded as Christians, although most were not truly Christians. So you have a tremendous thing happening, and God's people must be in hiding, basically, from 325. Small groups of them, they're not very large, we know little about them, but by the time we end class today, we'll be ready to proceed into that next period of time where we might find God's people. Here are some of the canons that were adopted by the Council of Chalcedon in 451, most of them carryovers from the Synod at Laodicea. The seventh canon, it's not important for you to necessarily memorize numbers, but to know them with recognition would be good, I suppose. I don't remember just which ones we'll put on the test, but probably some of them. The seventh canon of the Council of Chalcedon. Persons converted from heresy. That is, whether Novatians, Potinians, and Quartodecimans. See, now they are simply called heretics if you believe in the Passover on the 14th. And if you convert from being a Quartodeciman or any other, many kinds of heresy you could have, this is what you had to do. Whether they are catechumens or communicants, these are two grades of people who are learning or studying or having progressed to a certain point, can take communion or not, shall not be received until they shall have anathematized every heresy, and particularly that in which they were held. And afterwards, those who among them were called communicants, having thoroughly learned the symbols of the faith and having been anointed with the holy chrism, shall so communicate in the holy mysteries. So you can only come into that if you have purged yourself of all your previous heresy. And Quartodecimans presumably would have primarily have had to purge themselves of the Passover, and no doubt Sabbath and holy days and whatever else. I don't have any idea how many came back. The 16th canon of the council, very interesting. Still, 451, proclaiming the Gospels, and two things are important in this canon. The Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are to be read on the Sabbath along with the other Scriptures. The Sabbath meaning Saturday, not Sunday. The Lord's Day is Sunday. It is still a day of religious recognition. But in order not to Judaize, we don't keep it. We don't observe it. It's just, but they still acknowledge it as the day of the Sabbath. To the Catholics, so this is very difficult for some people to understand. The Catholics, as I've mentioned several times, always have regarded Saturday as the Sabbath. And I read you some good quotes on that a couple of classes back. Now, two things happen in this canon. One, we see the Gospels are recognized with canon as Scripture, which really doesn't matter to us, I don't suppose, whether the Catholic Church does or does not, except that the Bible is being preserved through this period of time, not by the Catholics, but is nevertheless is being preserved. God is seeing to it that the Scriptures are kept intact, and the Gospels are given that status, and that they should be read along with the other Scriptures, the Old Testament, are still acknowledged as being Scriptures. The 29th canon deals with the Sabbath, that is Saturday. When it says of it, Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day, and if they can, rest then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ. Now that's an interesting thing. That's the 29th canon of the Council of Chalcedon. It is the official law of the Catholic Church. And I have to presume is active and valid to this day. I wonder if it will be called upon at some time. I mean, in other words, you say, you know, things are, nobody knows these things. The average man on the street has never heard the 29th canon of the Council of Chalcedon in 451. But you can see the significance of it because in a religious court, let's say, not a civil court, but in a religious court, the Catholic Church could hearken back to the decree of this council for anything they may choose to enact if and when they become influential and powerful enough to do so. You could say, well, how could the Catholic Church enjoin the mark of the beast, let's say, which we summarize in general to mean the worship and trade required or forbidden on Sabbath and Sunday. How can the Catholic Church enforce such a law that people have to work on Saturday and cannot work on Sunday or cannot do business unless they have this so-called mark? of the beast. Whether that's some literal mark or figurative mark, we won't debate here. Well, they have the historic authority to do it. This was decreed in council. And they allege that, of course, the council is inspired by the Holy Spirit. Interesting, and one you should certainly know. If any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema. You keep those Jewish customs as a Christian. You are anathema, cut off from Christ. You're cut off from Christ, you're going to burn in hell anyway. When we come to the time of the Inquisition, you'll see the philosophy of the church at that time was, and you wonder, well, why did they torture people in the Inquisition? Why did they stretch people out on the racks and do painful things to them to make them give up their old religion or to accept the Pope or the Catholic Church and its doctrine? The reason is simple. If you're anathema from Christ, you're going to burn in hell anyway. If on the rack, they can torture you into recanting, even if you die, your soul gets to go to purgatory as you recant. It was going to hell anyway, and so if you die, what difference does it make? They'll just speed you on your way. That was the position of many of the inquisitors. Speed them on their way to hell, or maybe they'll recant and we at least get their soul to purgatory. And it all goes back hundreds and hundreds of years before to things that were done and decrees that were made. Very interesting. The 37th canon of the church. The council, rather, of Chalcedon. Number 37. It is not lawful to receive portions sent from the feast of the Jews or heretics. And you presume by that heretics who keep the feast of the Jews, that is, Christians who keep the feast of the Jews. And not to feast together with them. It is not lawful to receive portions from the feast of the Jews or heretics, nor to feast together with them. Number 38, the next one. It is not lawful to receive unleavened bread from the Jews, nor to be partakers of their impiety. Whatever that means. Number 39, following. It is not lawful to feast together with the heathen, nor to be takers of their godlessness. The kind of lump Jews, heretics who keep Jewish festivals, and heathens, all in one category. And later in the days of the Inquisitions, when the Roman, the European crusaders rode their horses down to the Holy Land, they came through city after city, brandishing their swords and their spears, and killed every last man, woman, and child in it, because they were either Jewish, heretics, or infidels. And the priest would pray before they went into a town to massacre it, "Lord, spare any good Catholics." And when everybody was dead at the other end of town, they concluded there were no good Catholics in town. Only Jews, heretics, and infidels. They killed them by the thousands. Crusades was a bloody time. We'll come to it. I'll talk more about it later. See what was happening, though. And the 51st canon of the church. This is not particularly important. I just thought it was interesting. The nativities of martyrs are not to be celebrated during Lent. But commemorations of the holy martyrs are to be made on the Sabbath and Lord's Day. I mention that because you see again the parallel acknowledgement. Sabbath side by side with the Lord's Day Sunday in the church. But how they always viewed it. They kept it as a special day of commemoration of saints. But you had to work on it and you couldn't Judaize. But they still have held the Sabbath with a certain kind of solemnity, I guess. And it is a day, as I said, to this day, Catholic communities that will have some religious significance. Now, we have talked a little bit about, and I wanted to summarize a few of these other things that were happening. I didn't have time to go through all of it, because it all kind of, again, dovetails into this period of time with Passover and Easter. We were talking about that during the last class, so let's finish our discussion on that, because Easter and Passover became one of the major controversies of the church. We should see at least how that evolved. There is a work by an author named Duquesne, and again, he's not important. The Early History of the Church is the title of his work, and he said of the controversy over Easter and Passover, there were many Christians of Asia in Rome at the time. Remember that the Church of God at Rome was founded by those who came from Asia Minor, where Paul had preached. and that the very early popes, now this is a writer looking back upon the bishops of Rome by the title later given to them, Sixtus and Telesphorus, saw them every year keep their Pasch, that is the Passover, the true Passover, the same day as did the Jews. They maintained that that was correct. It was allowed to pass, though the rest of Rome observed a different use. And this goes back earlier on. This is from the time, you know, in the first century, second century we've been talking about. I've mentioned Irenaeus a couple of times. He showed, I'll read you another quote about what he said. Irenaeus, if you have your little chart handy, you can date him there. The last half of the second century. Irenaeus, who lived toward the close of the second century, wrote to Bishop Victor of Rome, and Sixtus, they neither observed it, the true Passover, on the 14th of Nisan, nor did they permit those after them to do so. So the early bishops at Rome, you see, acknowledged it, saw it, permitted it to be observed side by side in Rome by the Asian Christians who were there, but they didn't observe it, and they didn't permit those after them to do so, so it was being solidified again. This name Sixtus is interesting. I don't attach any major significance to it. Sixtus, S-I-X-T-U-S, was a name that some of the popes have taken over the years. This goes way back into the early time when Sixtus the First came along. Interestingly enough, there have been five Sixtuses in the course of the papacy over the centuries. And should there be a pope who becomes, in the future, a pope, and who chooses to take the name Sixtus, he will be Sixtus the Sixth. Now, I don't see any major significance to that, but it would be interesting if he did. Let's remember that the number 666 has to do with the political leader, the beast, not the false prophet of prophecy, so I don't see that there's any major reason, but it would just be a humorous incident, and I'm sure a lot of people would raise their eyebrows at it if a future pope took the name of Sixtus again. Anyway, Sixtus the First was the first recorded individual to prevent observance of the Passover and to celebrate the sacred mysteries annually on a Sunday. Irenaeus speaks of him, declaring that his doctrine was in direct opposition to the practice of the remainder of the churches. Bishop Sixtus was living at the beginning of the second century, just after the Apostle John died. So from Rome, early in the second century, this would be 105, 110, 120, along in there, in the time of Polycarp's early ministry, the bishop at Rome is the first recorded individual to prevent the observance of Passover and to celebrate the sacred mystery on a Sunday, that is Easter, that is the resurrection of the Lord. So, again, we're filling in some of the gaps that we see what's happening here, and it's kind of hard to, I thought, well, you can do this all at once when we're coming to Sunday, but they've got these personalities and doctrines, and I've never figured out how to integrate them all into one flow, so we just keep kind of backing up and coming back to where we were again, and then taking another few steps. Irenaeus, talking about Polycarp's approach to it, and we've read a little bit about that, but this will help solidify it in your mind. Irenaeus says of that controversy between Anicetus and Polycarp over Easter and Passover, but Polycarp also was not only instructed by the apostles and acquainted with many that had seen Christ, but was also appointed by apostles in Asia, bishop of the church at Smyrna. He also was at Rome in the time of Anicetus and caused many to turn away from the heretics to the Church of God. And I come back to that because we have seldom seen that name mentioned. Just on rare occasions do we come up with it. I would like to see it a lot more. It would make it easier on us, but it doesn't come up very often. But it does in isolated cases. This kind of crop up now. So you see the name being perpetuated, but we, you know, it may be centuries before we pick it up again. He caused many to turn away from the heretics to the Church of God, proclaiming that he had received from the apostles this one and sole truth. That is about Passover. He was continuing to observe it like John had observed it all his life, who had gotten it from Christ on that night in 31 AD and how to do it.
While at Rome, Polycarp discussed the matter of Easter with the Roman bishop. Irenaeus continued, for neither could he, Anicetus, persuade Polycarp to observe it, the Passover, because he had always observed it with John, the disciple of the Lord, and the rest of the apostles with whom he associated. And neither did Polycarp persuade Anicetus to observe it, who said that he was bound to follow the customs of the presbyters before him. So let's say that's 150-something when this occurs. He goes back to Sixtus, who at the turn of the century was observing Easter, and we've got now the new tradition being perpetuated by a strong bishop at Rome named Anicetus. And so we see the evolution again of that was what was happening. Interestingly enough, about this same time, a letter was written which has been used by the Catholic Church as a form of authority for what they do. This letter has been acknowledged by most competent scholars as an absolute forgery. In fact, we're going to find that off and on through time, there have been major establishments of the Church that were based on allegations and on deliberate and perpetrated frauds that somehow became accepted as real events. Others of them may have been, I suppose, experiences that were really true. Here's what was said about this letter, about this period of time. Shortly after Polycarp left, there appeared an amazing letter, said by many scholars to have been a deliberate forgery. This letter states, quote, Pope Pius, who lived about 147, has made a decree that the annual solemnity of the Pasch, that is the Greek word for Passover, should be kept on the Lord's Day, Sunday. And his confirmation of this was that Hermes, his brother, who was then an eminent teacher among them, had received instruction from an angel who commanded that all men should keep the Pasch on the Lord's Day. That's from the author Bingham. You should at least be familiar with him. Bingham, B-I-N-G-H-A-M, Bingham, whose work is entitled Antiquities of the Christian Church. Antiquities of the Christian Church by Bingham. Again, I'll just give you these for your notes, that later on, should you want to enter into a study, you can make your own source book of books you maybe you want to get from the library or find to do some study. This is not something I expect you to go do now with your busy schedules, but just give you these references. Another author said of this, of this same hoax we read in Apostolical Fathers by Donaldson, you don't need to write that down, one of the letters forged in the name of Pius, where one Hermes is mentioned as the author, it is stated that in his book a commandment was given through an angel to observe the Passover on a Sunday. You can see a variety of authors look back to this event, which the Catholics attach major significance to. But it is based upon a fraudulent letter. So Passover being changed to Easter in the early 2nd century, right after the death of John, in Rome, we see it evolving, solidifying to a degree in the middle, but much more strongly solidified late in the 2nd century, as we round the corner from 200 to 300, in the time of Victor, who was bishop at Rome. By then, the tradition is established. What's it established on? A dream some guy said he had. And a false letter. Let's presume for a moment that this Hermes is a real man, and this is a real letter, and there is an angel, quote, who has revealed Pasch should be observed on the Lord's Day. What comes to mind that one should think? See if you think of the same scripture that I thought of that came to mind. Does a scripture come to mind? That'd be a good one. In principle, it says, yes. Yes. Excellent. There's another one in the New Testament. Yes, that would certainly be a good one. I think of yet another one. What if an angel told you to do something? Yes. Yes. Right, Galatians 1, 7, 8. If I or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel than that which you have received, let him be anathema. There is something to this being cut off from Christ, you know. There is something to being cut out. There is something to being a heretic. But of all things, what has happened, by the time we come into the 400s, the whole process is reversed, and true believers are now regarded as heretics. And heretics are true believers and have gained control. Well, that shouldn't surprise us, because even late in the writing of the New Testament, we have the name of a famous heretic, Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence among you, has gotten control of the church, and he has forbidden those who would to come in, you know, in the book of Jude. And from 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, you see that rising heresy where people are gaining control. But, I mean, I've said to God in my prayers, and I think it's correct to do so, not that God is doing that in this day, but if I ever felt I had a revelation from an angel, and I don't think God will do that in our day, I've told God, I'm not going to do it. If an angel tells me to go jump off the Empire State Building, I'm not jumping. So I don't think that's God's will to be tested in that way. Now, maybe Satan tried to tempt Christ to jump off the pinnacle of the temple. You might know he didn't do that either, to prove who he was. If an angel tells you, observe something contrary to the Bible, don't do it. God will not hold you accountable, and I can't imagine an angel coming to check you out on that anyway. And as one noted, we are to try the spirits, whether they be of God or not. One way you know is if they speak according to this word. So put all those scriptures we just referred to together. And even if this incident had occurred, it would not have been proper for the church to change the day of Passover that had been established by God in the days of Moses, and confirmed by Jesus, who changed the symbolism and manner of observance of the day on the night of the Passover in 31 A.D. Doesn't matter. An angel came or not. Just interesting how things go along. But rather, they wanted to observe Easter. Well, after all, Easter had been an ancient pagan festival. And it was very easy, as in the Saturnalia at the time of December, which we've talked about a little bit before, they wanted to make it convenient for those pagans to come into the Christian way and not have to change any more than necessary. So they established the date of Christ's birth in the Saturnalia, which is totally irrelevant. Wasn't born anywhere near the Saturnalia in late December, but months before that. But it was convenient to retain the pagan ways. It was convenient to continue to worship, to honor the birth practices of the goddess Ishtarte and her son Nimrod. Ever how that relationship was developed, I guess there are some questions as to who was married to whom and what. We may not always have that correct in the way it's stated of Nimrod and Semiramis and who they were in Isis and Osiris. But it comes from those ancient traditions and the abominable practices that were being done, that are being perpetuated to this day, which we expose in our literature. So I don't need to get onto that right now. Now, this controversy over Easter and Passover, as I mentioned last time, but one that must be familiar to you, because it's where you're going to find some of God's people who are called heretics. They are called Quarto Decimans. I mentioned that in the last class. Quarto Decimans, the Latin term, quarto deciman, meaning 14th. And so the controversy over whether the Passover would be observed on the 14th or its celebration change to an annual event on Easter was one that raged and has always been a problem to this day to some people. The Encyclopedia Britannica on the article Easter says this: there is no indication of the observance of the Easter festival in the New Testament or in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers. The first Christians continued to observe the Jewish festivals, though in a new spirit, as commemorations of events which those festivals had foreshadowed. Thus, the Passover, with a new conception added to it of Christ as the true Paschal Lamb and the first fruits from the dead, continued to be observed and became the Christian Easter. Generally speaking, the Western churches kept Easter on the first day of the week, while the Eastern churches followed the Jewish rule and kept Easter on the 14th day. And any historian can see what was happening. St. Polycarp, the disciple of St. John the Evangelist and Bishop of Smyrna, visited Rome in 159 to confer with Anicetus, the bishop of that see, on the subject and urged the tradition which he had received from the apostle of observing the 14th day. About 40 years later, in 197, the question was discussed in a very different spirit between Victor, Bishop of Rome, and Polycrates, Metropolitan of Proconsular Asia. That province was the only portion of Christendom which still adhered to the Jewish usage. You see, in that 50 years, from Polycarp's confrontation to Polycrates' confrontation, the only quarto decimans left were a small community. And Victor demanded that all should adopt the usage prevailing at Rome. This Polycrates firmly refused to agree to and urged many weighty reasons to the contrary, whereupon Victor proceeded to excommunicate Polycrates and the Christians who continued the Eastern usage. The few who afterward separated themselves from the unity of the church and continued to keep the 14th day were named Quarto Decimani, and with an I on the end in the Latin way, and the dispute itself became known as the Quarto Deciman Controversy. So again, if you want to look up where you might find Christians, the title is Quarto Deciman, or some derivative of that word. That's where you might find it. Continuing then, in the second century of our era, there were many churches in Asia that kept the 14th day, that is, the full moon of the first lunar month after the spring equinox, as Passover. They were called Quartodecimans, which means the keepers of the 14th day of the lunar month. Among the observers of the Quartodeciman festival are counted Polycarp of Smyrna, Melito of Sardis, Blastus of Rome, one of the traditions of the Syriac Didascalia, and the Epistle of the Apostles. In 194, Bonner published a new discovered homily on Passover by the Quartodeciman bishop of Sardis named Melito. In this homily, it is told that chapter 12 of the book of Exodus is first read in Hebrew and then translated. How the sheep is sacrificed and how the people is saved. Therefore, hear you, beloved. Thus, the mystery of Passover is new and old, eternal and transient, corruptible and incorruptible, mortal and immortal. This passage makes it incontrovertibly clear that the Quartodeciman Christians celebrated Passover. The name and date of the festival are in the same as the Israelitish calendar. So you see, again, late second century, it is firmly still a practice in some areas. I just wanted to read those to you. Okay, we'll probably break. We better break off there. The bell rang within a minute. And we will, after the test then, begin to discuss the next major title or group of people that we will see where God's people are given the title of Polycians in history. Some interesting information on them.